Echo and Harper Audio present The Secret History of Food. Strange but true stories about the origins of everything we eat. By Matt Siegel. Read by Roger Wayne. A note before we begin. Don't forget to download the accompanying enhancement PDF from your audiobook provider, or go directly to www.harpercollins.com/audio/secret-history-of-food. The enhancement contains the book's endnote. For my mother and her cooking, and my father and his eating. History celebrates the battlefields whereon we meet our death, but scorns to speak of the plowed fields whereby we thrive. It knows the names of the king's bastards, but cannot tell us the origin of wheat. This is the way of human folly. Jean-Henri Fabre. Of the many choices we make in our lives, what to eat is perhaps the most enduring and important. Whereas individual human beings can go through life without participating in political acts and without personal liberty, and can survive without forming a family or having sex, none of us can go without food. It is the absolute biological necessity of food that makes it so central to cultural history and so inclusive of all peoples in all times. B.W. Higman. Chapter 1. A History of Swallowing. The pursuit of more and better food has helped to direct, sometimes decisively, more often subtly, the movement of history itself. Ray Tannehill. Tell me what you eat, and I shall tell you what you are. These are the words written by Jean-Anthem Brillat-Savarin, one of history's most enduring and influential food writers. A guy who not only had a cheese named after him, a triple cream, semi-soft cow's milk cheese with a luxurious mouthfeel reminiscent of tangy, sour, and mushroomy softened butter, but whose book, Physiologie du Goût, Physiology of Taste, is still in print nearly two centuries after its 1825 debut. Granted, not all of Brillat's meditations have aged as well as his cheese. For example, his belief that eating starches softens a man's flesh and courage. For proof, one can cite the Indians, who live almost exclusively on rice and who are the prey of almost anyone who wishes to conquer them. His endorsement of sugar water as a healthy and refreshing tonic, or his frequent rants on obesity, suggest to a charming fat lady that she mount a horse and she will consent with great pleasure, but on three conditions. First, she must have a steed which is at one and the same time handsome, lively, and gentle. Second, she must have a riding habit which is new and tailored in the latest style. Third, she must have to accompany her a groom who is agreeable and good-looking. It is rather rare to fill all three of these requirements, so she does not ride at all. Or, I can remember only two really fat heroes. Note that Brillat-Savarin wasn't exactly svelte himself. However, he reconciled his own weight struggles, according to him, by having nice legs. Although I carry around with me a fairly prominent stomach, I still have well-formed lower legs and calves as sinewy as the muscles of an Arabian steed. Others are open to debate, such as his opinion on serving a cheese course, and simultaneously on the material worth of disfigured cyclopean women. A dinner which ends without cheese is like a beautiful woman with only one eye. Yet he was clearly ahead of his time on other points, being one of the first to extol the benefits of a low-carbohydrate diet, to draw a connection between the consumption of refined carbohydrates and obesity, and to urge parents to forbid coffee to their children with great severity if they do not wish to produce dried-up little monsters, stunted and old before they are 20, all notions that have since become common knowledge. And he was also right in his premonition that what we eat defines us not just physically, but psychologically, socially, symbolically and spiritually, to a much greater degree, in fact, than
sample complete. Ready to continue?